All right, welcome. This evening we'll return to our Bible study on our Sunday evenings to the book of 2 Samuel. If you open your Bibles with me to chapter 15, we come to return to where we left off last week with the story, the history of Absalom, the son of David, in his insurrection, his rebellion, his coup of the kingdom of David. And we come to the portion where we have the civil war once more, another civil war that David is now having to endure. If you ever considered, I mean, just think about America and growing up in the land that we do and the politics that we do and the history of this nation, what it would be like if our nation is thrown into a civil war with bloodshed, destruction, divisiveness and treachery. Which side would you be on if we backed up 150 years at our other nation, our nation's other civil war? You have the North and the South. You have literally, as was reported, relatives fighting on opposite sides, in some cases their own households, and just the difficulty that must have been like. And just to consider that, I can't imagine fighting against my enemy who happens to be my neighbor, a fellow citizen. And we need to pray that that never happens in our land and that peace and justice reign. But here we find David having spent some years, or probably a couple decades into his kingdom. He has established his kingdom. He has fortified his kingdom. He has expanded the boundaries, the enemies, the different threats of different nations or foreign nations are at a low at this point because he's defeated them. God has defeated them. And so he's in a good place. And yet, in the middle of it all, we find this tragic, terrible scene of a civil war of his own son rising up to take the throne and kill him, to have him put to death so he can take it all for himself. So David is here, what seems to be and what should have been a glorious time, a riding off in the sunset time, and just kind of playing out the rest of his years as the king in peace and prosperity, in a good, fruitful time for the nation, and he's having to fight and run for his life, literally. He's faced with this very situation, unforeseen, coming from his own son, and also in mind is the prophecy of God and telling him that the sword will not depart from your own house due to his sin, and God knowing this and the plan as it carries out, here's how it is displayed and manifested. And so it's a very difficult scene for us. Now, I want us to understand, I'm just going to walk through these chapters from chapter 15 and work our way all the way through chapter 19 and just read them. This is how narratives are to be understood. You don't just pick a verse and just kind of go off on it necessarily. It is a large story that God wants us to see with characters, with conversations, with activities and events and history that he brings forward, that we are to see it and read it in its context and see and hear the story as we keep in mind the character of God behind it. We keep in mind the people within the story who are the characters that God would want us to emulate or at least learn from in the lessons. As Greg said, that these things are written for our instruction. As the New Testament records for us, they're written as examples to not follow or to follow or to learn about the nature of man and the nature of God and how God responds and judges and blesses and forgives and restores, lifts up and tears down kingdoms, lifts up people and brings them down and replaces them with others. This is how God has done this, and we are to read the story and know that and see that in the background. So as we look at this text, what we want to be sure to see is that theology, what you believe, matters. What you believe about God, about the nature of man, about your own heart, about sin, the consequences of sin, the forgiveness of God, and yet how all those things work together, that matters. All that really does matter here. I want us to see David. I want us to see David in his response and to see, is he responding like that man after God's own heart, or do we see a little more of Saul here? I want to look at Absalom, and you want to see, is Absalom this prodigal son, like I said before, kind of like the prodigal son who has gone out, is he coming back with a heart like the prodigal son? Or is Absalom a lot more like another character we know of in the New Testament in Jesus' life? That one who is one of the disciples who would betray him. What type of man is this one, Absalom? And what can we know about this? What does the doctrine, what does the theology tell us that we can learn from? Because it does matter. It does matter. As you're going through tragedies like this, and circumstances in life, and stuff happens that you didn't want. This is not something that I think David would have mapped out for himself here. He's praying against what's happening here. He's asking God to prevent certain things, and God is answering his prayers either with yes or no, and how God answers the real issue here, do you trust God and the providence of God and what does happen? And there are things here that are very important as they carry out and they follow through in the history of David and the working out of how things are, that David and the man of God and the righteous are to lean on, and like the counsel was to Habakkuk, the righteous shall live by faith, shall believe in God and trust God even though it doesn't look really promising from the outside and looking at what's happening around you. So the theology does matter to the people of God as they endure through some pretty harsh situations, as was the case. Now, despite the flaws and the sin that have marked the last few chapters, we begin to see some true character here in David. And it starts to reveal why he is known as that man after God's own heart. Where is this one that is praying that prayer in Psalm 51, that confession in Psalm 32, that confession and revealing an understanding of his own condition of his heart? Is there humility here? Is that humility lasting and carrying forward? And I think you see a little bit of that here. How he responds reflects that type of humility and understanding of himself. So we'll pick up the story where we left off. David is in full retreat. He's escaping the city. He conquered. He defeated the Jebusites. He took the city of Jerusalem, and then he built his palace there, and he brought the ark there and the tent there, and his plans were to build a temple there, and then there would be Hiram, who would come later in his life and would begin to construct this beautiful city and the beautiful buildings there, first his palace, and then Hiram would also be the one that Solomon would use, as David counsels, to build the temple and all of his goods. Hiram, of course, the king to the north up in the Lebanon area. He would provide a lot of the workers and a lot of the resources. So here's this city, this beautiful city that David has conquered, and now he's escaping it. He's leaving. He's going by way of the brook Kidron to the east, up the slopes of the Mount of Olives, to the top of the Mount of Olives, barefoot, covered his head, a picture of his weeping and sorrow and humility and disgrace and what's about to happen or what has happened. And then he heads on down the slopes to the east towards the city known as Jericho to escape into the wilderness beyond the Jordan, often what's called Menahem and Gilead and what is over there in the tribes of the east. He's heading that way, kind of the opposite direction that Jesus did. Jesus came the other direction to head to Jerusalem to die. David's escaping Jerusalem so that he and his people would not die. So let's start reading. I just want to do that. I just want to read the story for us. And we'll make a few breaks here and point out a few things. The first part of this is the retreat and the retreat for the purpose of fortifying and protecting, getting himself in a safe position that he can then defend and protect himself from the assault of Absalom. Backing up in chapter 15 to verse 13, where we were last week, let's start reading into 16. And a messenger came to David saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom." Overnight, this just turned on him. The hearts of them were won over by Absalom. Of course, they were won over because Absalom spent a couple years here at the city gates kind of feeding their minds and feeding their good intentions and drawing them away from David to himself to trust David as a good judge, as one who can lead, who can provide justice in the land. Verse 14, "Then David said to all the servants who were with him at Jerusalem, 'Arise, let us flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom. Go quickly, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down ruin on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword.' And the king's servants said to the king, 'Behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord the king decides.' So the king went out and all his household after him. And the king left 10 concubines to keep the house. And the king went out and all the people after him, and they halted at the last house. And all his servants passed by him, and all the Cherethites and all the Pelethites and all the 600 Gittites who had followed him from Gath passed on before the king." Those three groups are typically assigned to or aligned as the bodyguard of the king. Many of them are foreign mercenaries. They're not of a particular tribe in Israel. And so you have these foreign mercenaries who've pledged their loyalty to David, and they're not leaving his side. They're going with him. Verse 19, "Then the king said to Ittai the Gittite, 'Why do you also go with us? Go back, stay with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your home. You came only yesterday. Shall I today make you wander about with us since I go, I know not where? Go back, take your brothers with you, and may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you.' But Ittai answered the king, 'As the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king shall be, whether for death or for life, there also will your servant be.' And David said to Ittai, 'Go then, pass on.' So Ittai the Gittite passed on with all his men and all the little ones who were with him, and all the land wept aloud as all the people passed by, and the king crossed the brook Kidron, and all the people passed on toward the wilderness. But Abiathar came up, and behold, Zadok came also with all the Levites, bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God, and they set down the Ark of the Covenant with the people until the people had passed out of the city. And the king said to Zadok, 'Carry the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and let me see both it and his dwelling place. But if he says, I have no pleasure in you, behold, here I am. Let him do to me what seems good to him.' The king also said to Zadok the priest, 'Are you not a seer? Go back to the city in peace with your two sons, Ahimaaz, your son, and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar. See, I will wait at the fords of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me.' So Zadok and Abiathar carried the Ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remained there. But David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went, barefoot, with his head covered. And all the people who were with him covered their heads, and they went up weeping as they went. And it was told David, 'Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom.' And David said, 'O Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness.'" A comment here. Ahithophel is an older man. He's part of the council of David, kind of like the advisors and the advisor council of David. He has these people, special hand-picked people, individuals who are older, wiser, good counsel, trusted by the king. Ahithophel was one of them. So he knows him, and Ahithophel knows David. And the fact that he learns that Ahithophel has joined Absalom and is abandoned, or he's turncoated on David, now he's concerned because Ahithophel can really bring harm to David. Ahithophel knows where David would go, knows what David would do. He knows his strategies, knows his policies, knows the way he thinks. And so this could be a real threat to him. So what does David do? He prays. He prays immediately. And we're starting to see David's heart. Now we're starting to see the theology that matters to David in the time like this. As he's escaping for his life and things are falling apart around him, he is turning to the Lord in what seems like it's getting worse. This is getting more dangerous. The more I hear, now I have this individual who could really bring this thing to a great end, a hard end for all of us. I need to call on God to be my rescuer. Oh Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Now note that prayer. He prays to God. He asks God to do this. Now maybe in David's mind at this point, he's thinking, Lord, what you got to do is you got to cause some craziness in Ahithophel's mind, or you've got to put words in his mouth to say to Absalom something that would sound like wise counsel that would lead Absalom away from what would be a strategic counsel that could lead to my death. Save us, save our people by seeing that Ahithophel says the wrong things. Do something with Ahithophel here. Work on his mind. But the Lord answers him in a different way. And that's in the very next verse. And we start to see how the Lord is with him and gives the answer. He just places in the hand of David right here a person, another counselor, that what David needs to do is continue to do wise decisions, make a good choice, and try to do something here that could help or at least could fortify and protect and be a wise course of action. And the Lord just brings Hushai, the Archite, to him. Verse 32, while David was coming to the summit, still right there on the Mount of Olives, and this is not a long walk for him, 5 minutes, 10 minutes up the side of the hill from Kidron Valley, which is only 5-10 minutes out of where the palace of David is. And so he's heading up, gets to the summit where God was worshipped. Behold, Hushai, the Archite, came to meet him with his coat torn and dirt on his head. David said to him, if you go on with me, you will be a burden to me. That probably means that Hushai is an older man and he could slow things down on their flee and he wants to take care of him, but it would be difficult. And so they got to be careful who's escaping, who's fleeing in the wilderness. They're trying to hurry. And he's probably saying that here, you may be a burden to me. It'd be probably better for you to stay. So David said to him, if you go on with me, you will be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in time past, so now I will be your servant. Then you will defeat for me the counsel of Ahithophel. Are not Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you there? So whatever you hear from the king's house, tell it to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Behold, their two sons are with them there, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son, and by them you shall send to me everything you hear. So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city just as Absalom was entering Jerusalem. So here's a counselor who's going to come alongside Ahithophel and other counselors to join with Absalom, only he's a spy. He's there for a reason, to gather intelligence to help David, to enable David and to buy David a little bit more time, a little bit more protection, a little bit more intelligence and information that they'd be able to predict and see what Absalom's strategies are before it comes upon them. And so we have David making some good decisions here. And this is, again, this is the answer, as we'll see, to the prayer, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. How will God do that? God does it through the counsel of Hushai. He'll be successful. And we see another character showing up, chapter 16. When David had passed a little beyond the summit, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of donkeys saddled, bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, and 100 of summer fruits, and a skin of wine. And the king said to Ziba, "What have you brought? Why have you brought these?" Ziba answered, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on. The bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat. The wine was for those who faint in the wilderness to drink. And the king said, "And where is your master's son?" That would be Mephibosheth. Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he remains in Jerusalem, for he said, 'Today the house of Israel will give me back the kingdom of my father.'" Then the king said to Ziba, "Behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours." And Ziba said, "I pay homage. Let me ever find favor in your sight, my lord the king." Now, we don't know the intentions of Ziba. If my guess is right, he is conniving his way to get all of the money, all of the land, and the power of Mephibosheth's house and the household, which is the house of Saul and Jonathan. Mephibosheth has never shown any indication that he's against David, and so we don't know whether this statement about how he wants his, he says he wants the house of Israel to be coming back to Saul, which would mean to himself. We don't know if that's true or not. There's no indication of that. Maybe that's Ziba just trying to work his manipulation. I think Ziba cannot be trusted. And I think David knows this, but what can he do? At this point, okay, I'll take the gifts you have, and whatever belonged to Mephibosheth is yours. You take care of that. You watch over that. And so that is the response at the moment. So we have people showing up, and as he's fleeing, you got Hushai, trustworthy? Sure. You got the priests who are there, and they're showing support and loyalty? That's wonderful. You've got the Cherethites, Pelethites, and the Gittites. They're all there to support. They're all there to be on his side. They're loyal to him. And then in the midst of this, here's another guy who kind of shows his loyalty, but then watch out. Be careful. Can't trust everybody. You have to be watchful. You don't know the motives. So he's in a difficult place as he's fleeing. Again, his theology has to work here. He has to trust God in this. Theology matters to him now rather than trusting men. Watch out. Not all that come to his side and try to help him out here are necessarily with good intentions. But with God, you can trust him. Moving on, verse 5. There's an infamous scene. When King David came to Bahurim, there came out a man of the family of the house of Saul. Okay, this guy is not going to show any type of pretense. He is showing all his colors from the start. The house of Saul, his name is Shimei, or Shimei, the son of Gera. And as he came, he cursed continually. And he threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David. Just rocks come flying down and pelting everybody. And all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. And Shimei said as he cursed, get out, you man of blood, you worthless man. The Lord has avenged on you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. See, your evil is on you, for you are a man of blood. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Abishai is the brother of Joab, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over there and take off his head. Don't you love it, those type of guys on your side? Let me just take this guy out. You won't ever have to hear that again. Now, how does the theology of David rise up right here? Watch what he says. Verse 10. But the king said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? If he is cursing because the Lord has said to him, curse David, who then shall say, why have you done so? And David said to Abishai and to all his servants, behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjamite, leave him alone, let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look on the wrong done to me and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing today. So David and his men went on the road while Shimei went along on the hillside opposite him and cursed as he went, threw stones at him and flung dust. And the king and all the people who were with him arrived weary at the Jordan, and there he refreshed himself. So here's the retreat. And the retreat with the purpose to fortify himself, to get his people away in a place far away with enough time between him and Absalom's forces to be able to fortify and protect and set up his defenses to then fight back if he is attacked. That's the plan that he has in mind. And on the way, you have these people showing up, and here's this Shimei guy cursing him on the way. It's a challenging situation for him. And the theology, trust in God in this. He doesn't retaliate. He doesn't complain. He doesn't respond in wrath. That may be a question there. Is David being a coward? Is he fleeing when he should stand his ground and fight Absalom and send the forces and send Joab after Absalom? He chooses to flee. He chooses instead to think about maybe this is the hand of the Lord. He remembers what Nathan had said, "The sword shall not depart from my house. There is going to be consequences for my sin. There is going to be trouble, and maybe this is the hand of the Lord. Who am I to oppose that?" He can continue to pray, "Lord, protect me. Lord, turn the counsel of Ahithophel. He's going to work against me. Turn it against him into foolishness. Cause it to not work. Whatever you're going to do, please, Lord, make sure that guy is not the one who's the downfall of us all." The Lord answers that, sends Hushai. Now Hushai is going to be set in place, waiting for his opportunity. The priests are going to be set in place, waiting for their opportunity to gain intelligence. They're going to send these two boys on the run for their lives with the proper information to save a whole host of people. So David is making wise decisions here, what he can do. He's making good choices here, but he's not reacting here in wrath. He's not reacting in complaint. He's not reacting in hasty retaliation. Shimei is cursing. David's not cursing back. This is the type of conspiracies and lies from the lips of Shimei seem to fill media sources today, every day. You got to watch out what is said. Trust God to fight your battles, to defend the legacy against false accusations. So David's reply here, while suffering, indicates really a frame of heart which controlled him. He looked beyond the false charges. He had all these people here. There's some people you can trust, others you cannot. You're dependent on some people here because you've learned their loyalty, you've learned their character. Others, watch out. We don't know about Ziba's character. So trusting in man is not the thing to do at this point necessarily as much as trusting in God and his providence. That theology matters most. Now, he was innocent of all the charges Shimei accused him of. He was not responsible for the blood and the fall of Saul's house. Your evil is on you. You're a man of blood, as if he is the one who put Saul to death. He is not. I mean, it's just foolish statements there. But what is David's response? There's a Christ-likeness. Not conspiring, but trusting the will and providence of God. Do you remember when Jesus came to Jerusalem? Now just picture this. This is like going in opposite directions. David is exiting Jerusalem, Brook of Kidron, Mount of Olives, and then heading down to the east towards Jericho. When Jesus came to Jerusalem in that faithful last month or so, he's heading up that hill through Jericho on his way to Jerusalem, knowing that's where he's going to die. David's fleeing death. He's trying to spare his people from death, and Jesus is going to die for his people. So there's something of this service of the will of God, in the sense, a noble activity, and Jesus is on the way. And in Jericho, which is through the areas in which David would march, is where Jesus runs into blind Bartimaeus, and he rescues and saves him. Zacchaeus, he saves him. He heads up the hills, and he finds Martha and Mary and Lazarus, and those scenes of that great scene in Gospel of John. And so a lot of ministry taking place on the way to the cross. He enters into Jerusalem, the Mount of on Mount of Olives there, on that day where he enters in, the triumphal entry, where everybody's saluting him coming in, but within days they're cursing him, and they're throwing vile accusations, false accusations at him, and abusing him and beating him up, much in the same way that Shimei is doing David. But Jesus is there to die on the cross. Jesus is there to fulfill the will of the Lord. Both of them going in humility, both of them not retaliating, both of them having to deal with turncoats. Jesus had to deal with Judas. David has to deal with Absalom and a host of others. Ahithophel, possibly Ziba, who knows? And so there's something of a comparison here between Jesus and David as one flees Jerusalem and the other enters Jerusalem in that final week. And there's pictures here that are needed to be seen and understood as they connect David to his son, Jesus. Now let's move on to the rebellion. Now we get a picture of Absalom in verse 15 of chapter 16. Here's the rebellion and the council that follows. Now Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem. So there's a large host of people have now sided with Absalom for whatever reasons they have. Who knows what? We can't really say, well, obviously David mistreated the people. I don't think that's the case at all. Well, David didn't really give them a lot of justice. Absalom did better. I don't know that's the case at all. I think he just kind of won them over like a good politician campaigning. It wasn't like Absalom earned this place here. He wasn't a warrior. He hadn't won big battles. He hadn't really done anything marvelous and magnificent for the nation. He just stole their hearts, and their hearts were now following him. So it's just this fickleness of the nation, much in the same way that happened with Jesus, where so many followed him, and then so many abandoned him. And so many said, crucify him, and put him to death. So here's the rebellion. David's son Absalom enters into Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with him. There's his counselor. Verse 16, and Hushai the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom. Hushai said to Absalom, long live the king, long live the king. And Absalom said to Hushai, is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend? And Hushai said to Absalom, no, for whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel have chosen, his I will be, and with him I will remain. And again, whom shall I serve? Should it not be his son? As I have served your father, so I will serve you. Then Absalom said to Ahithophel, give your counsel. What shall we do? Ahithophel said to Absalom, go in to your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you have made yourself a stench to your father, and the hands of all who are with you will be strengthened. So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and Absalom went in to his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Now in those days, the counsel that Ahithophel gave was as if one consulted the word of God, so was all the counsel of Ahithophel esteemed, both by David and by Absalom. And so here's the first counsel that asserts Absalom to take the throne from David, and he does this in a vile way, but it is the counsel of Ahithophel. Everybody thinks that's the right way to go. Whatever Ahithophel says, Absalom follows. This is the one we will follow. And so he's asserting himself. Ahithophel, by the way, the grandfather of Bathsheba. I don't know what his motives are. He's a great counselor, but he's now a turncoat. Here is the Judas to David. It could be Ahithophel. It could be Absalom. It could be any one of these. But there was a Judas. There was a traitor. There was one who betrayed the king. Now the question comes about war. Chapter 17. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, here's counsel number two, let me choose 12,000 men. I will rise and pursue David tonight. I will come upon him while he is weary and discouraged and throw him into a panic. And all the people who are with him will flee. I will strike down only the king. I will bring all the people back to you as a bride comes home to her husband. You seek the life of only one man, and all the people will be at peace." And the advice seemed right in the eyes of Absalom and all the elders of Israel. Okay, this is why David prayed. Do something to turn the counsel of Ahithophel. This guy can really do some damage. And indeed, this was the right thing to do. While David is running, he's yet to be fortified. He's yet to assemble his forces in defense. He's getting away. This is the time to pounce. This is the time to strike. That's what Ahithophel says. Get after it. Let's go tonight. And all we need to do is kill the king, and then we'll draw all the people back to you. You will be the new king. This is all it'll take. Let's do this. But then watch. Then Absalom said, "Call Hushai, the Archite, also. Let us hear what he has to say." Now, both of them were counselors to David. Both of them were trusted, probably elderly. They've got a lot of wisdom there. And Absalom is turning to those. So he hears Ahithophel's. Now, Hushai comes. Of course, he doesn't sense at this point that Hushai is a spy. That is, of course, of the Lord. He hides that from him. Verse 6, "And when Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom said to him, 'Thus has Ahithophel spoken.'" Remember, he's the word of God, like to the people. "Shall we do as he says? If not, you speak." Then Hushai said to Absalom, "This time the counsel that Ahithophel has given you is not good." Hushai said, "You know that your father and his men are mighty men, and that they are enraged like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. Besides, your father is an expert in war. He will not spend the night with the people. Behold, even now he has hidden himself in one of the pits or in some other place. And as soon as some of the people fall at the first attack, whoever hears it will say, 'There has been a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom.' Then even the valiant men whose heart is like the heart of a lion will utterly melt with fear, for all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man and that those who are with him are valiant men. But my counsel is that all Israel be gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba as the sand by the sea for multitude, and that you go to battle in person. So we shall come upon him in some place where he has been found, and we shall light upon him as the dew falls on the ground, and of him and all the men with him, not one will be left. If he withdraws into the city, then all Israel will bring ropes to that city, and we shall drag it into the valley until not even a pebble is to be found there." And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, "Counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel, for the Lord had ordained to defeat the counsel of Ahithophel so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom." There's the commentary. So Hushai speaks. "No, you don't want to go now. What you need to do is you need to bring everybody together, put together an army, and you, Absalom, lead them and go find David wherever he is in some city or some place, because he can't be taken now. He's too dangerous. But if you get enough warriors on your side, and if you get everybody behind you, then you can overthrow him and overpower him and defeat him, and then you'll have it all." So it's just a bit of a different counsel. It's delayed. This buys time for David to get away and to fortify and defend. But it is also the Lord doing this so they might bring this disaster upon Absalom. Here's the infiltration. He infiltrates. He gives the counsel. It defies Ahithophel's. Everybody sides with Hushai instead of Ahithophel. That is of the Lord. Then verse 15, "Then Hushai said to Zadok and Abiathar the priest, 'Thus and did, and so did Ahithophel counsel Absalom and the elders of Israel. And thus and so have I counseled now. Therefore, send quickly and tell David, do not stay tonight at the fords of the wilderness, but by all means pass over, lest the king and all the people who are with him be swallowed up.'" Now Jonathan and Ahimaaz were waiting in En-Rogel. A female servant was to go and tell them, and they were to go and tell King David, for they were not to be seen entering the city. But a young man saw them and told Absalom. So both of them went away quickly and came to the house of a man at Bahurim, who had a well in his courtyard, and they went down into the pit, or into it. And the woman took and spread a covering over the well's mouth and scattered grain on it. Nothing was known of it. When Absalom's servants came to the woman at the house, they said, "Where are Ahimaaz and Jonathan?" And the woman said to them, "They've gone over the brook of water." And when they had sought and could not find them, they returned to Jerusalem. After they had gone, the men came up out of the well and went and told King David. They said to David, "Arise, go quickly over the water, for thus and so has Ahithophel counseled against you." David arose and all the people who were with him, and they crossed the Jordan by daybreak. Not one was left who had not crossed the Jordan. And so here we have the counsel that is passed on, the intelligence given to David. David's able to escape and get out ahead and keep moving and spare everybody. So the spy network works. The spy network gets them safely to get that intelligence off to the king. God had provided in this way to protect David. More so, verse 23, "And Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed. He saddled his donkey, went off home to his own city. He set his house in order and hanged himself. And he died and was buried in the tomb of his father." This is Ahithophel probably thinking, if they're not going to take my counsel, it ain't going to work. He's going to lose. And then me, the turncoat, I'm going to be in trouble. I might as well take my life now. He had lost hope in this campaign, and so he does. He commits suicide, hanging himself. Verse 24, "Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan with all the men of Israel. And Absalom had set Amasa over the army instead of Joab. Amasa was the son of a man named Ithra, the Ishmaelite, who had married Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister of Zariah," so their relatives, Joab's mother. "And Israel and Absalom encamped in the land of Gilead. When David came to Mahanaim, Shobi, the son of Nahash, from Rabbah of the Ammonites, and Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lodebar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite, from Rogelim, brought beds, basins, earthen vessels, wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans, lentils, honey, curds, and sheep and cheese from the herd for David and the people with him to eat, for they said, 'The people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness.'" They escaped. They didn't bring all of their camp fixins. They didn't bring the trailer with the camp cook with them. They got out of there quickly. And so here are these people who had benefited by David's rule, who had provided for them protection from marauding foreign neighbors, and they understood this, and they had become well off, and they paid back David by providing for him in this time of need. Again, here is God providing, God caring and taking care. And they take up strategic position in this area, in the city, in the area of Mahanaim, which is east of the Jordan now, far enough away before Absalom arrives and the battle ensues. So here's the rebellion, and the rebellion is on, and now a civil war is about to take place. That's chapter 18. Let's continue reading. "Then David mustered the men who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. David set over the army one-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zariah." He is the brother of Joab, Joab's brother, "and one-third under the command of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to the men, 'I myself will also go with you.' But the men said, 'You should not go out, for if we flee, they will not care about us. If half of us die, they will not care about us, but you are worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, it's better that you send us help from the city.' The king said to them, 'Whatever seems best to you, I will do.' So the king stood at the side of the gate while all the army marched out by hundreds and by thousands. And the king ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai, 'Deal gently with, or for my sake, with the young man Absalom.' And all the people heard when the king gave orders to all the commanders about Absalom." That's an important feature to this war. But note this, there's war And here is the downfall of Absalom. Here's where the defeat happens, and it happens quickly. He sets up his, he's a good general, and the king sets up his forces in thirds, in three different fronts, and this is how they're going to withstand the attack from the larger army led by Amasa, who would be Absalom's side, and Absalom is with them. And so we're now ready to see the battle. So the army, verse 6, went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was fought in the forests of Ephraim. Apparently this area has trees and rugged slopes, and it's going to be a difficult fight in these forests, like fighting in Vietnam, I guess if you could picture that. And the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David. And the loss was great on that day, 20,000 men. The battle spread over the face of all the country, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. And so the defeat was clear here, that Absalom's forces were defeated, were taken out. In verse 9, and Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak. And remember, Absalom with the hair. Every year or whatever it was, he would cut his hair and would weigh 5 pounds, and he gloried in his hair. And as he's riding under this tree in the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, he was suspended between heaven and earth while the mule that was under him went on. And what a picture in Sunday school, right? Here he is hanging by his hair. I can picture Emily with her hair, hanging by her hair. And she has to be careful in these runs. We're in some thick forests in Kincaid Park. So just hanging from heaven and earth, that's kind of like a euphemism here. He's just hanging there. The mule has left him. No one's there to protect him. Here's Absalom. Here's the traitor. Here's the son who has betrayed the father. Here's the one who's the prodigal son who didn't come back repenting. He came back with murder in his heart. And now he's left hanging between heaven and earth with no one to rescue him or protect him. He is now exposed as God has seen fit. Verse 10, and a certain man saw it and told Joab, behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak. Joab, remember that character, Joab, said to the man who told him, what, you saw him? Why then did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have been glad to give you 10 pieces of silver and a belt. Now remember, David said, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. Joab says, no way. If I get a shot, if I get a chance, he's going down. And here's this young man who heard it. He heard this, and Joab is prodding him here and mocking him and saying, why didn't you strike him dead? And his response is this. The man said to Joab, verse 12, even if I felt in my hand the weight of a thousand pieces of silver, I would not reach out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, for my sake, protect the young man Absalom. On the other hand, if I had dealt treacherously against his life and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof. That is, if I killed him, you would have said, well, I didn't tell him to do it. So you deal with him, king. Joab said, I will not waste time like this with you. He took 3 javelins in his hand, thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he was still alive in the oak. And 10 young men, Joab's armor bearers, surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him. And Joab blew the trumpet, and the troops came back from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained them. And they took Absalom and threw him into a great pit in the forest, raised over him a very great heap of stones, and all Israel fled, every one to his own home. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself the pillar that is in the king's valley. This would be in Jerusalem. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. He called the pillar after his own name. It is called Absalom's Monument to this day. Now there is actually a monument in the area that is the Kidron Valley, Absalom's Monument. And it's not really where he's buried, it seems. But it is something for him to be remembered. But really, the only thing he's remembered for is a rebellion. And he's buried in some pit under a stack of stones in the middle of a forest, way off into the east of Israel. That is the legacy left of Absalom, a very sad ending at the hand of Joab. Verse 19, what's the response that David has here? Again, the theology. How is he going to respond? What about the news that he hears? Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, "Let me run and carry news to the king that the Lord has delivered him from the hand of his enemies." Joab said to him, "You are not to carry news today. You may carry news another day, but today you shall carry no news because the king's son is dead." Then Joab said to the Cushite, "Go, tell the king what you have seen." The Cushite bowed before Joab and ran. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said again to Joab, "Come what may, let me also run after the Cushite." Joab said, "Why will you run, my son, seeing that you will have no reward for the news?" "Come what may," he said, "I will run." So he said to him, "Run." Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and outran the Cushite. He's the better cross-country runner. So he had his times down, and he sped past that other guy to get the news to David. Of course, this is the son of one of the priests. This is the one who came of the two, Jonathan, and this one came to David to warn him that here comes Absalom. He's counseled from Ahithophel to destroy you. Get out, leave. And so he spared and gave him the right intelligence, and here's the same one. Now he's coming back to give more news, only this is bad news for him. So David was sitting between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof of the gate by the wall, and when he lifted up his eyes and looked, he saw a man running alone. The watchman called out and told the king, and the king said, "If he is alone, there is news in his mouth." And he drew nearer and nearer. The watchman saw another man running, and the watchman called to the gate and said, "See another man running alone." The king said, "He also brings news." The watchman said, "I think the runner of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok." And the king said, "He is a good man and comes with good news." Then Ahimaaz cried out to the king, "All is well." And he bowed before the king with his face to the earth and said, "Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king." The king said, "Is it well with the young man Absalom?" Ahimaaz answered, "When Joab sent the king's servant, your servant, I saw a great commotion, but I do not know what it was." And the king said, "Turn aside, stand here." So he turned aside and stood still. Behold, the Cushite came, second place. That's my notes. And the Cushite said, "Good news, my lord, the king, for the Lord has delivered you this day from the hand of all who rose up against you." The king said to the Cushite, "Is it well with the young man Absalom?" The Cushite answered, "May the enemies of my lord, the king, and all who rise up against you for evil be like that young man." The king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom. Would I had died instead of you, O Absalom, my son, my son." So here's the grief. War leads to grief. The rebellion leads to this great tragedy and grief to David. David is spared, but he is as sorrowful and broken as can be. He desired to have Absalom spared. That was what he thought would be best. That's what he wanted. And this whole tragedy, he would think, here's this man. It would be best if this is how it turns out. It didn't turn out that way. It didn't turn out that way because the hand of the Lord had other plans. The providence of God led in a different way. And for David, he wept. And yet, with that, it wasn't a complaint against God. It was sorrow. It was grief over the loss. He could look back and say, the Lord had prophesied this. The sword would not depart from my house, and now I'm experiencing it, and it is difficult. It is hard. It is grievous. But this is the plan of God. This is how things turned. I want a different, but the will of the Lord is what stands. And the will of the Lord is how things turn out. And so David would be in grief, and his morbid grief goes almost over the top here in chapter 19 until Joab steps in and rebukes him. Look what he says here. It was told Joab, "Behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom." So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people, for the people heard that day. The king is grieving for his son. The people stole into the city that day as people steal in who are ashamed when they flee in battle. The king covered his face and the king cried with a loud voice, "Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Then Joab came into the house to the king and said, "You have today covered with shame the faces of all your servants who have this day saved your life and the lives of your sons and your daughters and the lives of your wives and your concubines because you love those who hate you and hate those who love you. For you have made it clear today that commanders and servants are nothing to you. For today I know that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased. Now therefore, arise, go out, speak kindly to your servants, for I swear by the Lord, if you do not go, not a man will stand with you this night, and this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now." I don't know if that's a veiled threat there from Joab. "I will make this happen." But he is right in saying the others. You make it as if it would have been better that we all died and Absalom alive as opposed to the other way around. And so this is a rebuke. And David's response is this in verse 8, "And then the king arose, took his seat in the gate." He just humbly picked himself up, went out to the gate, which is where he receives all the armies back as they come back into battle and receives them and welcomes them in and says and shows his appreciation. And the people were told, "Behold, the king is sitting in the gate," and all the people came before the king. And this is how this scene ends here before we can move on to the rest of it, which we'll do next time. David needed to honor the loyalty of his soldiers for the price they paid in putting down the rebellion, and he did. He needed a rebuke from someone to do that, to get him out of that great grief he was in because he just lost another son. This would be the third son dying under his watch. There'll be another son that will fall later, as we'll see. But right now, it's hard. It is difficult what he's going through at this time. And I think the only way anybody can really be steadfast through this, respond through this, and carry themselves through in the end in faithfulness is to have good theology. Theology matters here. Trusting God's providence. Trusting God will do what is best. Trusting God hears prayers and answers them. And trusting God is a forgiving God. And that is what David believes. So here we are in the great of this, the great deal, the midst of this tragedy and this danger. Let's remember that David trusted in the providence of God. As he prayed and appealed to God to intervene, God answers. He protected those who were his responsibility. He acted decisively. He made good choices. He was careful. He was helped by others. He was cautious in other ways. He needed others. He needed others, their advice, their wisdom, their rebuke. He humbled himself. He received from the hand of the Lord what the Lord allowed. He had to kick the habit, which you saw earlier in his life, of that knee-jerk reaction of that fighty, retaliatory, self-defense type of wrath. Remember, he was ready to do that on Abigail's family. He had to kick the habit of that too quick of a response, back up, think this through, and trust God through this process. Instead of the anger of man, which does not achieve the righteousness of God, he sought the wisdom of God. So, can we pray instead to God to come to our aid, protection, change the hearts of our opponents when we're in this? Can we not retreat, fortify, rather than lash out in sudden attack, self-defense like David? Can we put our trust in what God is doing, even though we don't understand it at the time? Or as would be said to Habakkuk, you wouldn't believe it if I told you. But God is going to do this, and God will carry this through. And in the end, things will be worked out for good for those who love God. And David would have to trust that. Good theology matters through this. I don't know how you would carry yourself without that. So let's stop this point. We'll pick up the next time where David finds himself restoring the kingdom and returning to Jerusalem. Let's pray. Lord, I do thank you for this time to walk through your scriptures, to read these words, to hear them, and in our minds try to relate, try to learn, try to draw the lessons, to see David, see the example of David as he responds to not one, but two and more proved to be a Judas to him, and the threats that are there, the dangers that he faced, and to learn from him the example of a man who turns to God in prayer, who pleads with God to protect, to rescue, to fulfill and do his good work. And Lord, help us to learn that trust, to learn that understanding of the providence of your hand as you work through circumstances and people, enemies and friends, trusted companions and those who are not so trusted, that we might respond well, that we might walk in faith, that we might walk with the heart of David and give honor to you in this and wait for you in this and find in you our shelter, our refuge, our strength, our tower of defense, that in the end, when it comes to that final assessment and analysis at the end of the battle, we find ourselves standing by your promises, standing with you, standing on the side of the righteous, standing steadfast in our faith, not failing. May you keep us strong in this, Lord, as we pray. I pray this in Christ's name. Amen.